You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. The U.S. Supreme Court gave President Trump a wave of victories in the final week of its session. Joining me now to talk about what the court's rulings mean for birthright citizenship, parental rights, and more is University of Cincinnati College of Law professor Anne LaFaso. Welcome back, Anne.
Hi, Lucy. It's good to be here.
Great to have you. Okay, so I want to start with this case that's centered on the issue of birthright citizenship. Explain what the Supreme Court ruled in that case.
Okay, so it didn't rule on the merits, which means it didn't talk about whether or not the president's executive orders were actually constitutional. It only ruled on whether or not an individual district court judge could actually issue what's called a universal or a nationwide injunction. So the court said that this is almost certainly not within the power of a district court, and therefore it limited the it gave the president a limited victory. The victory is just has to go to complete relief of the individual plaintiffs who came forward. So in other words, each individual that could be affected by this has to get their own injunction, although there might be there might be a way around this that Alito figured out and said you can't do, but none of the only I think Thomas joined with him and the others didn't, which I'll get into in a second. But it's limited just to injunctive relief. So what does that mean? It just means that in the court's opinion, that one, the district courts just don't have this power, and the reason they don't have this power is because there is no analog in English law at the time of the founding in which you could just do these universal injunctions, and nor did any of the early courts do that. Hmm. And so they went back to that time and said, since this wasn't in the common law, and since in equitable relief, injunctions are equitable rather than legal relief, since it's equitable relief and you could only have what you had at common law, the only power that that Congress gave to courts was the common law power, it can only do that. I'll just say one more thing is that the courts can only exist because Congress created them. And so there's something called the Judiciary Act that creates these courts, and it's the Congress would have to add something if it wanted them to have this type of extraordinary power.
Pass some kind of law that gave them the power, essentially.
Right. And then, of course, the Supreme Court could say whether or not they thought that was constitutional or not, but yes.
So does this decision increase the power of the executive branch?
It can, but yes, it can, but it can also hurt it, right? It could curb it because, for example, there are two judges in different districts in Texas that issued nationwide injunctions against the NLRB to enforce the act because they said it was unconstitutional, which is outrageously funny. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's outrageous since the Supreme Court has repeatedly held that the National Labor Relations Act is constitutional. Now, under this law, you can't do that. So there's going to be lots of different ways in which you could actually curb the power of different parties. Here, they actually said that the president didn't get everything he wanted. What he really wanted would have been that you get full relief, that there's no injunction. The fact that they did not give that says to me that the court is ready to actually rule that birthright citizenship that his executive orders are unconstitutional. Why? In order to get an injunction, you have to show probability of success on the merits. Well, the injunction is actually not stayed for people. If it's not stayed for people, then it seems that the Supreme Court left that intact, which suggests that they're not as concerned about that. So now I'm not saying that they're all going to do that, but I think there's a really good chance that they will find that birthright citizenship, that the executive orders are unconstitutional.
That's really interesting. And you mentioned those cases in Texas. So sometimes these federal judges issue these broad injunctions that are good for the president in power, and sometimes they're not good for the president in power. So
that's
I guess
right.
You're saying it can kind of go either way depending on what the case is and what the judge orders. Yeah. So, and you mentioned the court did not take a stand in this ruling on whether President Trump's executive order regarding birthright citizenship is constitutional. You think there were some clues that they're ready and they're going to possibly rule it unconstitutional when they consider that question. What is this little piece that you said Justice Alito and Justice Thomas were hinting at?
Okay. This is really interesting. So there's two doctrines. One is called class action, and the other is third-party standing. So a class action is essentially when you have a lot of people in the same position, and so you try to get relief for them. So it seems like we could have a class action here, right? Well, Alito suggests that he warned the district courts when they apply the class action rule, which is actually a procedural rule under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. So that dictates what the procedures are for federal judges. He actually warned them not to apply the class action broadly.
Isn't that kind of the definition of a class action, that it's kind of broad?
Yes. So and also when you read his concurrence, and I've been concerned about Justice Alito in the last several years because he seems to get angrier and angrier. So he seems like he's writing with emotion, which judges should be as dispassionate as possible and not put their personal feelings into these things. So it just struck me as really odd. And I'm pretty sure that Thomas joined in that, which doesn't surprise me because they've been kind of a pair lately. The other thing is that third-party standing. So these are often in abortion cases or other cases. So like a doctor will bring an abortion case on behalf of a woman for whatever reason. So the doctor doesn't have standing, but there's a reason why the woman doesn't want to come forward. Okay. So, and it's a very limited exception to standing. Now, why does he bring this up? He says, you know, this is very limited because the states are actually engaging in third-party standing here. Now, if you only need 50 injunctions plus DC plus maybe Puerto Rico, if you only need by state, that's a lot easier to get than would be millions
of people individually suing
right.
for relief.
Yeah. And remember, it's not going to be every state either, because frankly, the red states with red governors are probably not going to do this. But California, New York, Massachusetts, they're probably would be interested in doing this. And so I think that's going to be the next battle.
Really interesting. We're talking about some of the consequential rulings the Supreme Court released last week. Do you have questions or comments about them? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. So you mentioned this whole class action thing. Could a class action lawsuit accomplish the same thing as these injunctions? And I'm going to ask you to get just a little bit closer to your microphone.
Sure. Yes, I do think it could, but the judges would have to allow the class actions, and there are rules for the class actions. So I'm not sure it would. Actually, let me take a little bit of that back. I don't think it would accomplish exactly the same thing, because what was going on was there was complete relief for every person, regardless of whether they came in. Whereas with a class action, you have a representative of the class, and then you have to fill it up. So, but it would be, again, a lot easier than going person by person by person.
Mm-hmm.
So it would slow down the president's ability to actually deport people, even though they are clearly citizens under under the Constitution. So this is a point I really wanted to make that I think is important. Nationwide or universal injunctions are an extraordinary relief. That's absolutely true. But what I don't understand, and this is what the dissent points out, is that where it's so clearly unconstitutional, why wouldn't you have an exception? Where this is, this is against the words of the Constitution. This is just reading English. I think, and the only thing that gave me some hope on this was I believe that seeing what Alito wrote and what I think Thomas is also interested in suggests that they're worried about this. And so they're saying, hey, heads up, guys, this is the next challenge. So get ready. And I think that the court is that will be a battleground. Yeah.
Worried about this in that worried that that this challenge on the merits of the executive order is coming next. Do you mean
it would come through these other way, like the class action and through?
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. Talk a little bit more about how the dissenting justices responded to this. It was the three more liberal justices who dissented, right?
Well, they make pretty much the similar point that I was just making, which is, but I think Jackson was extraordinary. And she's really come out as an extraordinarily brilliant jurist, I think. She was talking about how this really hurts the rule of law. And think about it. If the president can do whatever he, she, they want, then they can just say, okay, we're going to take everyone's guns. That was an example that Jackson used. And then you have to go person by person. There's got to be relief for that. It can't just be that you don't get relief. What if they say women can't vote? What if the president has an executive order that says only Republicans can vote or only Democrats can vote in the next election or no independents can vote? Clearly unconstitutional, clearly illegal. There's got to be something. And that's what I think that the dissent was also saying is that what they said, what the majority missed was what the basic function of the court was, which was to do justice. I thought that was very profound by both dissents. Hmm.
So you mentioned that, I asked you, does this ruling increase the power of the executive branch? You said it's kind of a mixed bag with that. What does it mean for the power of the judicial branch? I mean, is this taking power away from lower court judges?
Yes, it does. It also is going to create a lot of litigation. Once again, lawyers win. And I do think that the president's power in general will be increased, though, even though it's a mixed bag. I do think the president can win. I think the real problem is that people tend to like things when they think they agree with the resolution. And so no one seemed to care about these injunctions when it was against the NLRB or against Biden, but now all of a sudden they care about it. When the real solution is, if you don't like birthright citizenship, you have to get a constitutional amendment. And they know they can't get that, and that's the problem.
Yeah. Does this make the Supreme Court more powerful? As I understand it, Justice Kavanaugh said, hey, the buck stops here. You know, we can rule on these things 24/7, 365. If there's some kind of emergency ruling that has to get made, just send it our way.
They always had that power. And that actually made me think, I was thinking about Kavanaugh, did the majority rule this way in part because they were concerned that the president wouldn't obey their order? So this was sort of like a way to start to get him to obey. In other words, that was Marbury versus Madison, right? Marbury versus Madison, they said, oh yeah, you're right, except we don't have jurisdiction, and so we can't enforce this. So it read to me a little bit like that, and I was wondering if that was what Roberts and Barrett were really doing. And that's why Alito was concerned about there's this loophole. I mean, I don't really think it's a loophole. I think it's a legitimate procedural. But I think I'm just guessing now, but this is what my lawyer brain, that's what I would be doing right now. It's a game of chess, essentially.
Hmm. Let's talk about one of the other rulings, and it's this ruling regarding educational materials and the ability for parents to opt out because of religious objections. Can you tell us just briefly about that case and what the court decided there?
Yeah, that's a really interesting case. So basically, a school board in Maryland introduced LGBTQ plus books that were supposedly, or actually were, considered approved for students between kindergarten and fifth grade. I read one of the storybooks, and it was all about love, but it was same-sex love. Now, we never question the sincerity of someone's religious beliefs. So the court doesn't do that. So parents sincerely believe that that is against their religion. And so they asked for this opt-out, which they got for less than a year. And then so many people were opting out of it that the board stopped allowing the opt-out. So that's what this is all about. And the question was, well, is this a freedom of religion case? It was actually an injunction case again, but they went into the merits. So it's really, even though it's an injunction case, they basically decided this. And they said, yeah, that parents have rights. These are really, the way they wrote it, I would give it an A, whether I agree with it or not, on an exam, but I would also give the dissent an A, the way they wrote it. In other words, both are grounded in the precedent. So parents have a right to raise their children the way they want to raise them, and there's always been opt-outs for this. And they said this does burden religion because the parents have a right to actually raise their children in a certain religious way. And they for lots of technical reasons, didn't say, well, that's not really a burden on religion and all that. Okay. So I think the real problem here is the fact that we live in a country that is concerned about innocuous storytelling. The reality is that we live in a pluralist country, and we live in a country where children are exposed now to their friends who have same-sex parents, and schools have always tried to educate students just to understand the world, even if they don't agree with them. Now, I think the court made a good point in saying that it's not fair to say to these parents they could always go to private school, because then you hurt poor parents that have these sincere religious beliefs. So I have a lot of sympathy for that. And that's what other people say. Well, just go to your religious school, your private religious school. So in a lot of ways, it's a difficult question. On the other hand, it's what happens now if parents are saying, well, I don't believe in evolution. That's my sincere religious belief, which it is for some people, especially young earth creationists. So you can't teach my child that part of biology. Mm-hmm. That's a big, big problem. And there is Supreme Court precedent on that that seems to say, yeah, you have to teach evolution is evolution and religion is religion.
Yeah. We do have a caller on the line I want to take real quick. Hey, Todd, thanks for calling. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, hi. Thanks so much. Great conversation. Really helpful explanation of the birthright citizenship ruling. My question is, we have a very conservative court. They seem to be handing the president more and more power. I think everybody sees them as the last hope to kind of stop Trump from getting too much power. Is this normal what we're seeing, or is this unusual in our history that the court just seems to be giving the president more and more power?
Interesting question. Thanks, Todd. What do you think, Anne?
That's a great question. There's a book by Professor Newstead about precedential power that I think was from the 50s originally, but I might be getting that slightly wrong. And the president has been grasping power more and more since the New Deal. And we do have it has accelerated. So I say it's not unusual, but since, say, in the 1930s, we have seen a a trend in that direction. Now, Truman's power was cut off in one case in Youngstown, but in general, we are seeing it accelerating now. And that's what people are reacting to, is how fast it's happening. And that's a problem because there's less check on the president, and that's one person, as opposed to what the Constitution really was supposed to do, was put most of the power in Congress, which was spread over all the states and all the people, and really ultimately the people.
Yeah. Thank you, Todd. Thanks for that question. We appreciate it. So we are running short on time. There's always so much to talk about, but I guess I wonder, what's your big takeaway from these rulings and the way this session ended? If you were trying to explain this to your class, what would your big takeaway be?
Well, one of my takeaways would be, as I told my students this semester, is anything that deals with children, they're almost always going to find a way to approve. And so in some ways that doesn't surprise me, because they were saying some sort of harm to children, although I personally don't see the harm. But that aside, I would say that what it really shows is the additional ideological division in the country, and also that this president is going to do anything that he wants and will challenge it. And we're going to see, what we need to see is, where are the limits? And that is the last hope. Whether they're going to do it or not, we don't know. But the court is the last hope, because the president doesn't see boundaries for himself.
Well, I have been talking with University of Cincinnati College of Law professor Ann LaFaso. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Lucy. I enjoy being here.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.